All right, let's think about the Bema Seat of Christ. Bema Seat, very important. Reward, not punishment. Reward, not punishment. For Christians, we will never know what it's like to be judged underneath the wrath of God. We'll never know what it's like to be punished by God. Let's think of 2 Corinthians 5:10. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. This word for judgment seat, bema seat. This was the seat that was used, for example, in Corinth, Greece, where Paul had to sit before the authorities. He sat on the bema seat. This is a place of judgment. And Paul's saying, yeah, there is going to be a bema, the seat where Christ is going to sit on the seat and judge believers. For what? For what they've done, good or bad. The word here for good is agathos. It means useful, beneficial, or pure. The word here for bad is not evil, like there's a word in Greek for evil. This is phalon, which means morally substandard. That has a moral property to it. Or relatively inferior in quality or ordinary. So when we see good or bad, it almost sounds like if you do good things, if you do bad things, like it could be taken in the sense that the things you did which are good, which are useful, like the Christian businessman who creates 80 different fast food restaurants, and he gets up to the Bema seat and he turns to God and he's like, here, God, here's my work. I made 80 fast food restaurants. And God's like, wow, awesome. Now what on earth am I going to do with 80 fast food restaurants? That wouldn't be an agathos. That wouldn't be useful for anything. That would be in relatively inferior quality, ordinary. Now, the person who comes up and says, God, I led multiple people to you. I discipled multiple people. I gave money to the poor. I shepherded, took care of younger believers. I laid my life down. God's like, yeah, that's agathos. That's useful, pal. And you're going to get rewarded for that. 1 Corinthians 9:25, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable wreath. We studied this recently, didn't we? The concept of a perishable wreath, an athlete is giving up all of these freedoms. Like, athletes aren't going to be smoking a half a pack a day. They're going to pass on the chocolate donuts. It's like, oh, so what, you're not allowed to smoke? It's like, I'm allowed to do it. I just don't want it. I'm trying to do something here. I'm trying to win that wreath. You can't have a chocolate donut? Yeah, I can. You can't stay out late? I can. I'm just trying to get up early to train. I'm in the Olympics here. The Isthmian Games in Corinth. Paul's like, yeah, they do that to win what? A perishable wreath. He says, we've got something imperishable here we're trying to win. The Stephanos, the crown, is the image of a wreath, an award or prize for exceptional service or conduct. The picture here isn't that the Olympic Games, if you don't get gold, you get shot and drug away. The imagery here is you work hard, and if you get gold, you get a greater reward. People who don't place, they don't get silver, bronze, gold. Well, they don't get punished. They just miss out. This is the language of opportunity, not the language of punishment. The principal passage on this is in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 12. If any man builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident. For the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. Each man's work, that refers to each individual believer. And notice, it isn't that the fire is burning the man. It's burning up their work. It's revealing something. Its fire is testing what you did with your life. If any man's work which he has built upon remains, he will receive a reward. There you go. This isn't a punishment. This isn't the concept that you're showing up to get judged. for wrath, it's judged for the purpose of reward. Even 15, if any man's work, notice how much he's talking about the works here, is burned up, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. So you could suffer loss. Zimeao is the term. This is the term used of financial loss. Like the stockbroker who wakes up and sees that the stock market completely crashed. That's zemiao, suffer loss. I blew it. It's worth nothing. He himself will be saved. So there could be believers that come to Christ, do relatively nothing useful. He says they will still be saved, yet so as through fire. So sounds like these people are getting through the flames of this test. The flames are licking their butt as they're getting through. They come out, and it's like they survived the fire. They're unscathed, and yet everything they live for is just a fistful of ashes. Nothing to show for it. At this judgment, one of the things that is, what's the word? Sobering. Is that it's not just that our works are going to be shown, but our motives. Why we did those things will also be shown. 1 Corinthians 4:5. So this is the next chapter after 1 Corinthians 3, what we just read. Wait until the Lord comes, who will bring both to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. It's not just what you did, it's why you did it. And then each man's praise will come to him from God. So it's sobering to consider he isn't using this as a threat, if you notice. It's not like, oh, watch your motives, or, you're going to lose it. He's saying God's going to judge the motives so that he can find something to praise every believer for. He's going to find at least one thing to praise for each Christian. Some more than others, apparently. Think about this question. Are eternal rewards selfish? Like, basically, if I'm living a Christian life for these rewards, isn't that just like the person who's living a life for a career where they're doing all the sacrifice but so that they can get something back in return? Critics usually bring this up, skeptics. I think the first point to make here is that self-interest isn't necessarily selfish. There's something that could be in my self-interest that isn't selfish. I remember getting hit with that by a skeptic. He said, this is really selfish. And I was like, well, you know, self-interest isn't being selfish. He's like what? I was like breathing. Like breathing is in my self-interest, but breathing isn't selfish. Drinking water, that's in my self-interest to do that. Having kids, getting married, a lot of things are in my self-interest, but they're not selfish. And the same thing is true here. Well, why isn't breathing selfish? Because there's like, I'm speaking hyperbolically, infinite oxygen around here, okay? Plenty of it. It's not like I'm taking it away from you so I can breathe it. That would be selfish. But there's plenty to breathe, and I'm going to sit here and hold my breath when there's plenty of it here. God is sitting there. He wants to give out rewards. He's got an inexhaustible treasury of rewards. And he's like, I want to give these out. And you're sitting there saying, they're free. I can give them to you. Oh, no, that would be too selfish. No, that would be too prideful is the word you're looking for. It'd be prideful that God's saying, I want to give to you. And you're saying, no. Too holy for that. Also, motives are checked. So if you're living your life in such a way, as the skeptic is claiming, where you're just doing this to get something in return, that itself is part of the test. That I'm doing this out of love for God and for people. I'm taking in His love, that He loved me first, then I'm giving this back out. And so doing anything in your ministry or service for Christ out of a selfish ambition, that is checked at this judgment. And as we pointed out, God is sitting here saying, I want to give to you. And you're saying, no, that would be too selfish. That reminds me of when I had two family members. Whenever we go out to dinner, they were always fighting for the check. Everybody's like, no, I'm going to pay. I mean, they would actually wrestle the check. Because it's like, you know, some of them are like, well, I don't want you to pay because I raised you. You know, and the other one's like, well, I'm a grown man now, and so I want to be able to pay for myself. And really, it's just like, okay, why can't we just let one person get the check of the other? Why does it matter? When people take me out to dinner, you know what I say? Thank you. I want to pick up the check. Thank you. I'll offer, you know, I'll pick up the next one or whatever, and very Christian thing to do. I appreciate that. It's also a Christian thing to do to pay for the bill. Finally, this reward seat is going to be pretty surprising. Based on Matthew 25, think about this passage. Verse 34, come to me, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty, you gave me a drink. I was a stranger and you invited me into your home. Then these righteous ones will reply, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? And the king will say, I tell you the truth, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me. You pick up what I'm picking up from this passage? That it's possible that there will be people getting rewarded in heaven, and they don't even remember what they did. When did we see you naked? Oh, no, no. You don't remember? No, I remember. And God is sitting there saying, I'm keeping track. Every single thing you did, I'm going to dish out the rewards. Jesus says in Matthew 20:16, one of his most repeated passages, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. One of the great privileges of heaven is going to be to see those people who are the silent servants, of which there are many in this church. People that don't get the spotlight, aren't up front on stage, and yet they make basically everything we do in this church possible. They do all the serving behind the scenes, and to be able to see the people who are always out in front step back, and to see those people step forward, I don't know. That's going to be a pretty powerful day. Those people that you really root for, and you're like, I wish they got the recognition that they deserve. It's coming. All right. Can we lose eternal rewards? There's two different views on this. One view is that if you do something that was out of a pure motive and you did it for the kingdom, you did it for Christ, that that's like almost like getting transferred to a bank account and it's storing up eternal rewards for you. But what about the guy, I'm thinking of a very famous pastor, minister, author. Back in the 70s, he had led hundreds of thousands of people to Christ. He had a book that was on the bestseller, New York Times bestseller, for a period of 3 months. Not like just Christian books. I mean, all books. Sold 10 million copies. Would speak around the world. Led countless people to Christ. Hard to estimate. And then it came out one day that he was going out on his wife. And they busted him for it. Then it came out, he went out on her again. And they busted him for it. And again. She finally left him. He got remarried. Did the same thing with her. Now he's on his third marriage. Still in the spotlight. He's still, he's got his own TV show and everything. Does it mean that all that great work that he did before, is it like he's going to get rewarded for that and that's just static? Like, once you do something, you get that reward. It's in the bank. Or is it the second view that God doesn't look at individual acts of faith, but instead he measures your whole life, each man's life work? And so for a guy like that, he did all this incredible work, and yet there's another sense in which he brought incredible disgrace on the name of Christ. And maybe God takes that into account as well, and then he shows up and says, okay, here's your reward. I don't know. I go back and forth on this. For one, Paul says, who is our reward? Is it not even you? Right? So if I lead somebody to Christ, he is my reward to be able to see him in heaven. So in that sense, I can't lose my reward unless that guy ends up going to hell. or something like that. That doesn't make sense. Yet there's another sense in which we can lose reward. Think about 2 John 8. He says, watch yourselves that you do not lose what we have accomplished, but that you may receive a full reward. Don't lose the full reward. Maybe it's that God looks at your life, and if you don't finish to the end, you don't get those rewards. Maybe that's why there's so much in the New Testament about making it to the end. It's not enough to follow Christ for 3 years. You got to follow him to the end. Hebrews 10:35, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. If you lose confidence, you lose reward, in other words. And so that is the Bema Seat. Heaven is a place, but it's mostly about a person. Mostly about a person. To be with God, to be with Christ forever. Makes me wonder, are we too focused on the rewards of this life? Like a lot of times when we talk to new believers or fellow Christians, it's always like, oh yeah, you should serve because, you know, Jesus promises in John 13:17, if you serve, you'll be makarios. You'll be happy, fortunate, blessed. You know, or, if you follow me, you'll get 100 times as many brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and persecutions also. Following Christ is satisfying. Following Christ is fulfilling. And it's really sweet. And it's like almost like cheerleading. You know what I mean? And I don't want to disparage any of that. That's all true. It is. Following Christ, there's nothing like it. I've been doing it for over a decade. Love it. Love it more now than ever. It's awesome. Enjoy it. And yet I wonder if we are too focused on the rewards of this life. Like think of Joel Osteen's book, Your Best Life Now. I think we could see very quickly the contradiction of a Christian author making that claim. Our best life is not now. Our next life is our best life. Why don't you read that book to a person under persecution? This is your best life now. That's not what the Bible teaches. Blessed are you who are persecuted. You will rejoice. You will rejoice. So I wonder if there's something similar there, worth pondering. It isn't that the teaching of having rewards in this life is absent from the Bible. It's there. It's just I wonder if we need to keep our emphasis on the eternal rewards, which is why the Bible commands us, it's an imperative, to dwell on the things above, zeteo, to deliberate, to reflect, to think about. I remember one time at a prayer meeting, we were sitting around, a few of us believers, and we started to pray about this topic. The prompt was, why don't we spend 10 minutes just praying about all the things we're looking forward to seeing in heaven. And people started to pray, and it was just one thing after another, after another, after another. And we went on for half an hour like that. We actually never even got around to petition, praying for people. I mean, it's kind of messed up. But we walked out of there very happy, very excited. And I think that's part of this here. A lot of this is in prayer, to dwell, just to sit there and think about where we're headed, that this is real. Jesus promised this. He says that where I go, there you will be. I go to prepare a place for you, many rooms there, and to look forward to this with some real delight. Can't wait for that. That's all we got.